Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And thank you very much for joining us today for another hour of Midrats. And if you're with that esteemed group that is listening to us live, please go ahead and scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you will find a link to the chat room. And if you feel so inclined, feel free to jump into the chat room with the rest of the usual suspects. And if you have some observations during the course of the show you'd like to share, that's the perfect place to put it. Also, if there is a question you would like for us to ask our guest that you may not think we're going to get to, or you just want to emphasize what a great question it is, you can go ahead and put it in the chat room. Eagle One and myself will be monitoring that during the course of the show. And we'd love to go ahead and steal your ideas and fold them in before the hour runs out. And if you have to run out because you're a big Tar Heel fan and you can only catch the first 5 minutes of the show, you can always get the full archive later over at Blog Talk Radio, or just take the long-term view and subscribe to the free podcast over on iTunes or Stitcher. But hey, let's go ahead and roll into the show. And today we're going to kind of touch on a subject that it's not quite an evergreen topic, but it's something that does come up on a regular basis, which means that maybe it's something that just hasn't been addressed properly. And that's wondering, from a surface warfare point of view, can you really have too much of a good thing? When it comes to assessing our junior officers, do we have too many? Do we have the right amount? And what is driving the number of junior officers in the surface warfare community? And what is benefiting that? Either what part of the Navy does that benefit the most? And some of the justifications that may exist, and the secondary and third order effects for those justifications on the fleets. We're going to look at how the numbers, policies, and priorities have all mixed together in that important few years in which we train and develop our junior leaders at sea. And as a touchstone for our conversation today, we're going to use an article by our guest in the March 2017 proceedings titled "Too Many SWOs Per Ship." And that will be Lieutenant Brendan Cordial, United States Navy. And with Brendan today, we're going to not only discuss the issues he raises in the article, but we're going to look at other responsibilities that junior officers have in the fleet and some of his experiences he's had that might inform a larger conversation about how we bring up our junior leaders. Lieutenant Cordial is a native of Beaufort, South Carolina. He graduated from the University of Notre Dame in 2011 through the Naval ROTC program, is where he got his commission. During his division officer tours, he served on the USS Iwo Jima LHD-7 and also the USS San Jacinto CG-56, both boarded in Norfolk, Virginia. He's currently helping to grow the next crop over at the Naval ROTC unit at the George Washington University in D.C. Brendan, welcome to Midrats.
Hey, thank you very much there, Commander Salamander and Eagle One. I appreciate it. It's a great pleasure to be here with you this afternoon.
Well, you're welcome, and it's good to have you on board. And I wanted to kind of, before we really dive into the topic themselves, I know a conversation that we've had over the course of the years on Midrats, and something that I've talked with a lot of people who are in the national security arena, is how do you get junior officers to engage in the marketplace of ideas, to go out there and to put their ideas out and to get that creative friction going on. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that, just like you're coming on today onto Midrats, on Midrats today, you are representing yourself, Brendan Cordial. Nothing you say here represents United States naval policy or United States or any of the units you may be associated with. It's just Brendan Cordial. And a part of that is, you know, putting yourself out there personally to take the slings and arrows if they may come, or the laurels with the ideas. And just talk for a little bit how you got to the point you said, this is a topic that I want to write about and I want to get it published in Proceedings.
Yes, sir. The idea for the article itself, you know, as I mentioned there, I had the distinct pleasure. I don't know if they published it as such, but I put it in quotes when I wrote the original submission, of serving in the shipyard two times during my, you know, on each ship on Iwo. I got her right before I did the workups and the deployment, and so the last year or so after completing the deployment and earning all my qualifications, which was fortunate for me, I left the ship in the shipyard. And then when I met San Jacinto, she was already on deployment. So I did about half of the deployment with San Jack and then came back to the shipyard. When you're underway, when you're at sea, it's relatively easy to get, you know, folks qualified because, you know, everyone's standing watch, 24/7 operation. But I saw, you know, both from the new, so, you know, I was fortunate to show up, get all my qualifications and then go to the shipyard. But then the new batch of ensigns, they report to the ship just like they do during any other time of the cycle. But they were definitely struggling because, you know, their quals were stagnant because, you know, if you're not underway, you can't qualify as officer of the deck and you can only, farm out so many of your ensigns to other ships that are underway because, I mentioned in the article, but I mean, they have a ton of ensigns that they're trying to qualify on their ship as well. And then, I saw that repeated on San Jacinto and, it kind of struck a chord with me both. You know, I was pretty fortunate that it didn't stymie my personal progression. I was training officer on San Jacinto. So I was pretty, I was involved, with the senior watch officer trying to implement the CO's vision for what a SWO qualification looked like. The challenge of trying to get a meaningful qualification process for people when there's only a finite amount of, opportunities to stand watch, to participate in evolution, which are all critical, in the short term for achieving the initial SWO qualification. But as I started to think more deeply about it, none of the department heads really stand quarterdeck watch. So every it's much more typical for your department heads, SWO department heads, to serve as tactical action officers. They might be kind of some kind of funky con coach or something assisting the officer of the deck, but it's and this is only my experience, but just talking from peers, it seems like it's relatively normal across the fleet. That is your division officers are standing deck watches. So if you're put in a situation as a JO where there's a finite number of, evolutions you could participate in, you don't really, the focus of your department head time at sea is on fighting the ship and CIC vice driving. And, you go from a JG, say, leaving your first ship, a recently promoted lieutenant leaving your first or second ship at 4 years, and you've accumulated the bulk of your actual deck watch standing experience, and that's the person who's going to be the CO, the destroyer, as a 16 or 17 year time of service commander. And what does that say about the system if we're essentially relying on such a fine, a relatively limited number of actual experiences? There's always the simulators and, you can kind of supplement that. So I want to take a look at that. The article really was predicated upon, my master's program that I'm doing, which is, here's a plug for the Naval Postgraduate School, is a lot of, simulation modeling that I'm doing with that. And I was like, what's the, given a ship cycle, what's the best case? What's the worst case? What's the average? And then, does that make sense when you look at the numbers of, given all the variables involved, with a division officer tour, what actual experience is it likely that someone can get? What's the best case? What's the worst case? And, is that acceptable? Honestly, so ships are serving at sea. They are accomplishing their mission. It's very rare for a ship to experience a mishap. You know, there aren't ships running aground all the time. So, you know, whatever is happening is working. But I think some other questions we could get into is, you know, is it more stressful than it needs to be because of, you know, a bunch of different reasons. But that's really what got me thinking about that is just that, you know, I spent a significant time of my afloat tours not being afloat. And I think, you know, for junior officers, the vision and the, you know, the long-term trajectory is say, hey, I want to be a ship CO someday. So if you're, you know, the designated at sea time, you don't really get to be at sea. And what that means for the amount of experiences, you know, amount of practical experience you get, crafting your, you know, becoming a better ship driver, et cetera. You know, was my experience like how unique was that? And, you know, can we look at it more systemically to see what we're doing for our junior officers?
Well, that's a great point. I think one of the things that struck me in your article and proceedings was what I call the role of bad luck, and I think you just touched on that with your the young officer reports to a ship that is just entering a yard period, and yet as he goes down through his career, we compare with officers who've gone right out to units that are going to sea, and so those other officers will qualify sooner and all that. Just out of curiosity, what did you guys do with those new officers who showed up while you were in the yard period on either the LHD you're on or the cruiser?
Yes, sir. So on first ship, I was in engineering, so I wasn't as involved. And again, I was already qualified. So, I didn't get farmed out to any ships on a LHD. You know, there's only, so EWO was in Norfolk at the time, but you know, the intent is to get someone on a similar platform, which is a little bit more challenging if there's fewer hulls. So there's only, you know, I think there was three or four LHDs in Norfolk at the time. So you were kind of beholden to the other ship. So it made it more challenging. On San Jacinto, you know, there's more cruisers and there's not necessarily a significant departure or a difference as far as ship handling goes for cruiser destroyer. So I know on San Jacinto there was a much more concerted effort. So you would try to get the ships going on, say Comp 2X or basic phase training, and you would send them over as they could to get some underway experience. A lot of it's going to be, you know, so the SWO qualification ultimately is driven by the commanding officer of the ship. That's going to be, you know, how comfortable is he or she with, you know, the CO on the other ship and what, you know, that CO says about how Ensign Cordial did stand and watch, that kind of thing. But I suspect that even if you were able to kind of achieve a relatively normal amount of underway time, on another ship while your ship happened to be in the shipyard, you know, I think by and large, most COs would be reluctant to actually qualify a young officer without actually, you know, themselves observing them. So, you know, while you might still get a little bit more experience, if you're, you know, kind of the support system around you on the ship is effective at getting you farmed out, that you're still going to be kind of, you know, the roadblock, you know, of you actually getting underway and that CO actually observing you. Is going to hold up your qualifications. The advantage of being in the shipyard is that you can take advantage of the simulator. So they do have a pretty legitimate simulator. It's full design like the inside of the bridge of a ship there in Norfolk. And I've seen the one in San Diego, and there's, you know, I imagine there's similar ones in, you know, the other major fleet concentration areas. So, you know, you can take advantage of that. The challenge of, you know, of getting enough training time is that there's competing priorities on the ship. You know, you have to actually be a division officer. You know, the shipyard, particularly the latter portions, are usually pretty hectic for the ship because they're trying to get everything back working again. There's the impending basic phase and ATGs coming on board to assess everything. So there's a fair amount of pressure on the ship. And one of the easiest things to cut out of the plan of the week is junior officer training. So while you can't take advantage of the simulators, it's easy to you really need a lot of buy-in from your CEO to make the training of junior officers a priority, which, you know, for better or for worse, is going to kind of depend on the individual. And then, you know, availability, because, again, even though it's there, there's a lot of other ships, you know, it's a finite resource as well. So there's a lot of other ships who have mandatory training that you have to do as part of the training cycle for a ship. And then the other problem that's addressed in the article is if you have, you know, the per officer simulator time is a function of how many officers you have to go train. So if your wardroom, you know, is 25 JOs or whatever it is, you know, they're going to get, you know, you might only get one round or one round through because you have to cycle everybody through, as opposed to, you know, if you have fewer officers, then each officer would get, you know, necessarily for the amount of reserve simulator time, each officer would get more training time. So ships, you know, I was fortunate that the ships that I was on, they definitely, it seemed to me as a junior officer that they made a good faith effort, but nothing can, you know, nothing can replicate actually serving at sea, you know, actually doing real world operations for meaningful experience. But I think ships, I think, you know, so my personal ships, they did make a good effort, and I think it was, you know, reasonably effective, but it's not ideal.
You know, what's interesting is when you compare it to other warfare communities, for instance, the aviation community, so many things, whether in the wardroom or at a bar, references the number of flight hours you have on the tack air side of the house, how many traps you have, and that's on top of any of the various qualifications you may have. And, of course, aviation is a little bit different because you show up warfare qualified at your squadron, then you work in your specific platform from there. But there's the very real fact of you only have 24 hours a day in addition to training and mentoring your junior officers in their professional development. Once you do get underway, commanding officer also has to be focused, more importantly, on the safe operation of his ship. If you could talk for a little bit about having all these various competing bodies over a finite amount of bridge time and then how that can manifest itself at sea with the watch bill and how they write the watch bill and management. And are there some second and third order effects to that?
Yes, sir. So you're exactly right. And again, it's one of those things where, you know, it's kind of a pay me now or pay me later, I think, in a lot of ways. So, the surface warfare, you know, training system, the qualification system is predicated on, you know, by and large on the job training. So I was pre basic division officer course, which they, recently stood up. So, once, you know, so they went way before my time, I think in the early 2000s or right at the end of the 90s, SWOs initially went to a 6-month, I think, you know, plus or minus a little bit, formal course of instruction up in Newport, Rhode Island. That was prior to showing up to their ship. And then they nixed that, and essentially you got something called SWAS in a box, which is, it was computer-based training that essentially the intent was to teach the curriculum. You would self-learn advice being taught at Rhode Island. The challenge of that, obviously, right, is that just like you mentioned, so, you know, while you wouldn't, you know, 20 years ago, you wouldn't show up to your ship qualified, you would show up at least with some type of baseline knowledge that could facilitate you being more, you know, quickly, you know, stood up as a competent watchstander. I think it's been ameliorated a little bit with BDOC, but again, it's, you know, so BDOC, I think, is 2 months compared to 6 months. You know, it might not necessarily be maybe BDOC is much more effective because the curriculum's tighter, or, you know, the feedback from BDOC is very positive. But the main point is that I think two things can happen. You have a CEO who is totally buys in to the future of the organization. He or she thinks that all their junior officers should get equal opportunity, that, you know, the watch bill, everyone's going to be on the watch bill. It's going to be a, you know, a typical 4 or 5 section once you get enough people qualified, and we're just going to cycle through and then everything's, you know, fine, or it could be fine. The other tendency is to almost make a varsity team where, you know, the CEO finds a couple of folks that he or she is particularly comfortable with. They've proven that they, you know, are a competent watch stander. Maybe the CEO is more risk averse, or, you know, I'm not one to judge the CEO's decisions or whatever, but, you know, you get the few watch standers that, hey, when a special evolution is coming on, it's, you know, they show up on the watch bill to serve in the special evolution instead of, say, the officer that might typically be on watch at that time. Which is good, you know. So one of the kind of the underpinnings is as far as the service community, I think that's kind of a negative, because you have such a small sample size that CEO would be making that determination on, right? So maybe that officer is very good the first time he stands, you know, conning officer of the deck for an unrep, and the CEO's like, oh man, this guy knows what he's doing. And so, you know, next time, you know, I'd be more comfortable he's up there again. And so he gets a lot of opportunities. But his peer, maybe who, you know, for whatever reason, they, you know, the first time they got their go at it, they weren't quite as effective. So it's, you know, in one way, it's good for the ship because the CEO is comfortable that the officer they have standing the watch for these special evolutions is good. And, you know, it's likely that it's more likely that the evolution will go smoothly. But it's easy for the other officer who never gets, you know, more than, say, you know, for your PQS, your qualification process, you have to get the signature saying, hey, you stood officer of the deck one time for unrep or whatever. You know, he gets that one chance, and then he never gets to stand it again. You know, it's never formally stated, or I doubt you would ever see a watch bill that said, hey, varsity team's on. But, you know, it's not formally stated, but those kind of it becomes readily apparent in a wardroom that, you know, there may be multiple tiers of JO, you know, deck watch standers. And I think that can be pretty damaging. So both to the individual who's discouraged because they can't get a shot, but then it's not really fair because maybe that officer is actually a good watch stander. He just needs, you know, maybe he recognized what he messed up the first time and now he would correct it and be awesome. So there's kind of a, because of the competing priorities of accomplishing the mission, the CEO, you know, wanting to do things well, that kind of, you know, he's not necessarily measured against, okay, how well did you incorporate all the JOs on the watch bill, or how evenly did you spread the amount of watch standing experiences of your junior officers? It's, did they get qualified, and did you accomplish, you know, or so did you qualify your watch, did you qualify your junior officers? You know, did you have too many attritions or whatever? And if the answer is no, then I guess it's kind of assumed that you're doing well. And then, you know, the CEO is more readily a judge, okay, did you accomplish the mission? Does that make sense? And so, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with that, but it doesn't necessarily do justice to identifying and developing as much of the talent, I think, as you could otherwise.
Well, it does pose the question about what the purpose. I mean, I always thought my job was to train people to replace me, and that the future, you know, I was, especially as I got older, the future relied on me making sure the people that were following after me were at some risk, at least as competent as I was, and hopefully in many cases far more competent than I was. So is that something we should pay more attention to in terms of the demands? We certainly place enough demands on commanding officers, but is that one of those things we should really flag as, you know, this guy does a great, or my gal does a great job of training JOs who will go do great things for the Navy down the road?
That's an interesting question. I think the challenge would be, and again, I've never been a Commodore or anything close to it, so I don't know what actually goes into, you know, their assessment of whoever's writing the FIT rep for their COs. I think the ideal state, you know, given how, as far as I understand, kind of the current performance, you know, assessment system works is, you know, that CO who can balance, you know, balance the requirements of the ship, right? So he or she's ultimate responsibility isn't necessarily to qualify junior officers. It's to lead the ship effectively into whatever mission, you know, it's assigned. So that has to be priority one. But priority two, so long as you can accomplish priority one, would be to, you know, effectively develop the future. So some of that might have to be, you know, I don't know how you would quantify that, but kind of a qualitative assessment of, you know, how rigorous was the training, you know, the qualification process, how, you know, did the ship make a good faith effort to make sure that, you know, everyone's qualifications were meaningful, that everyone had a large enough sample size of ship handling opportunities to make, you know, to give the CO a good indication of whether or not, you know, they maybe had a knack for it, or maybe, you know, they didn't have a knack for it. Something I forgot to mention on the, in the, previous question, the other phenomenon that can happen once you have kind of the different tiers is, which I also don't think is all that positive, is you'll identify, or the ship will identify, you know, their hot runners, the guys who are really good. And then because they've already demonstrated aptitude or, you know, performance in a certain, you know, say they're really good ship handler, really good deck watch sander, they'll kind of move them on to the next thing. Because like I mentioned, it's not so much how good you are at your particular watch station, which, as far as, you know, how you break out amongst your peers, it's the number of qualifications that you achieve in your initial tours. So for a division officer, you need, you know, there's one thing that the ship handling component is one aspect of it, but there's the engineering officer qualifications that you're supposed to get as a division officer. And then if you are, you know, super superstar, it's not unheard that you might achieve, you know, the TAO, so the tactical action officer qualification in your division officer tours. And so the other pressure on the CO is, so if he or she identifies someone that they think is really talented and they think is going to be, you know, the next best thing, set up letting them get more deck standing time or deck watch standing time, there's pressure to make sure that, oh, hey, let's make sure we get Ensign Smith down to engineering so we can get his EL qual. And so, you know, as soon as he gets his qual on the bridge, okay, now you go to engineering, and then you get your engineering qual, and okay, now let's get you up to combat. So it's kind of I don't know, it's some people kind of rail against SWOs being generalists, which I think is a different topic, but I think the not so much dangerous, but the slightly negative aspect of it is again, it's you're just looking at such a small sample size of say experiences. So say, you know, the guy is awesome. Two times he's up there for an unrep. Okay, he's shown that he's awesome, and now we got to get everyone else in there so that guy doesn't get you know, more opportunity to do well. And say, you know, if he's the guy who thinks it's awesome, and say 20 years down he's the CO, you know, he's kind of been given the thumbs up, you know, based on his initial performance, but then in actuality he didn't really stand all that much watch, and now he's the CO 16, 17 years later, that, you know, only has that finite number of experiences. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how you would quantify or like force COs to, and that might be too strong of a word, to, you know, prioritize the development of their junior officers outside of the qualification process. I think maybe a more effective or a more feasible tack would be to, you know, ensure the rigor of the SWO qualification process, and then, you know, achieving say 95% or 90% or whatever the you know, qualification rate would be for a CO during his or her tour, you know, that might be more meaningful than, you know, because, you know, now it's essentially based on the CO's judgment, which a lot of things in the Navy, you know, I'm not saying you should take away from the decision or the authority from the CO, but there is significant variability between ship to ship as far as qualification time, qualification rigor, et cetera. So if we were systemically going to take a look at the problem, we'd maybe have to come up with some, you know, baseline rigor for this qualification process, And then, you know, then you could quantify the metrics of, okay, the CEO made sure that, or the CEO developed a training program and supported his JOs, and that resulted in a, you know, a well above average qualification rate as compared to, you know, the rest of the COs in the squadron, that kind of thing.
It seems in many ways that a lot of the issues you raised in your article are byproducts of some perverse incentives and warping externalities that derive from reverse engineering a system to make it reach a desired end state. And one of those, to say something very cynical, but one of the answers that you get from the bureaucratic blob, and I think all of us have a little bit of the bureaucratic blob in us, just some of us have the billet description that actually does that, is a lot of the reason that we have this very large cohort of junior officers is doing the reverse engineering of, at some point, we need a certain number of major command C billets from which we make our flag officers. And when we look at our attrition rates through captain, lieutenant commander, even, you know, first tour lieutenants, in order to have that designated number of major command at sea billets and to have an appropriate pool of people to do a quality cut on, because of all the calculus, we have to have this number of junior officers coming in the pipeline. So, you know, shoehorn them in and make it happen without really addressing why you have that attrition rate and why we have the career path that we have that in many ways facilitates that type of attrition rate. Do you see that bureaucratic blob answer of as being a valid answer to the concerns you raise? And if so, is it something do you think can be addressed on the margins or something that really needs to be root and branch restructured to perhaps bring something more in line with the requirements of the Navy today?
Yes, sir. So that is indeed a very interesting question. I'm by no means a qualified manning expert and not involved in making the, you know, the big level, you know, decisions that go along with that. And it is a challenge because the, you know, just on the junior officer level, again, I'm going to ballpark the numbers. I haven't seen them extremely, very recently, but, you know, just from kind of conversations with senior level people I've spoke to who are a little bit more informed than me, that the historical, retention rate, say for SWO JOs, is something on the order of 35% to 40%. So it's exactly that issue, right? If you need, I'm just going to make it up, but say you need 1,000 department heads 8 years down the road, that means you got to, or say 400 department heads 8 years down the road, you got to assess 1,000 ensigns and distribute them, you know, among the ships, given the historical attrition rate. It is a function. At some point, you either decrease the number of ships or increase the number of ships so that you can get the spread that you want, or you decrease the accessions and somehow increase the retention, which, you know, if they gave everybody a bonus of $1 million, I'm pretty sure retention would explode, but, you know, that might not be that feasible. So some of it's, the monetary incentives they could provide to promote retention. But really, the historical average retention rates is largely a function of people's, you know, quality of life and professional experience during the division officer tours. And quite frankly, I think the bevy of ensigns you have doesn't do much for the individual's professional experience while they're afloat. And kind of like a lot of the factors I said, so, you know, if you're not the guy getting picked to be on the quote-unquote varsity team, then you're going to be much less likely to want to stick around, even though, you know, if you had maybe a little bit more opportunity, maybe you would blossom and do great. Same thing that I get into a little bit is that, once you're no longer an actual division officer, right? So it gets sold to you as, hey, you're going to lead from day one. You're going to have a chief. You're going to have a division of, you know, 15, 20, however many guys. You're going to get a lot of management and leadership experience from, you know, the day you step on board and being part of this this great team that is your ship. And then your, you know, reality is, hey, you're the third division officer in CG division. And, you know, there's only two chiefs in the division. So, you know, and you're the junior guy. So there's two other guys more experienced than you. And so you're kind of in a funky middle state where, you're a division officer, but you're not really the division officer. And so, you know, the expectations aren't really jiving. The only way, well, not the only way, but I think kind of the, what the system or what the, you know, we as a community would have to be willing to accept, hey, you know, we recognize this is not an ideal state. Like we, you know, we would rather not have, you know, the majority of our SWOJOs choosing to depart the service, after their initial tour. So we're going to make sure, you know, we're going to implement these, you know, 1, 2, 3, initiatives to improve the professional, I'm kind of hesitant to say quality of life because I don't think, you know, the people we would want sticking around are necessarily worried about, you know, how much liberty time, or, you know, how much MWR events they got, or, you know, so long as you are engaged in meaningful work that you feel is rewarding, that you are, you know, leading sailors, that you're getting an opportunity to hone your craft as a ship handler and as a tactical watch sander, and your performance and efforts are well, you know, acknowledged well, you feel like an integral part of the team. I think by and large, you know, the SWO life, would be very attractive to that, but it's the, kind of the acceptance of, hey, we're not going to do anything, you know, no matter what we do, the 40%, retention rate isn't going to go up that much no matter what. So we got to make sure, you know, based on our projections 8 years out or whatever it is to get our department heads, we got to have this many folks. I think you'd have to change that paradigm to say, okay, I think we can retain 50% of our officers, and so we're only going to assess, you know, that much lower ensigns. And then that means, okay, you know, ensign Cordial gets, you know, a little bit more time to stand watch. He gets a little bit more simulator time. He's actually the division officer, so he gets to, you know, experience that coordination with the chief and lead the division. And so, you know, that on the aggregate would ideally produce a higher retention rate. If it doesn't work out, and again, you know, I definitely don't begrudge the folks who have to try to map, look into the future, 18 years, 20 years, or, you know, almost 30, if you're talking about flag officers, looking to the crystal ball to make everything mesh out. But the risk you would have to accept is that, hey, we might not get the department heads we need. You know, that'd be the first kind of main stumbling block. But we're willing to accept that, as a community, if you're a serving department head, your tour might be extended because your relief's not coming on time because we don't have enough, that kind of thing. So that, I think that's practically how the trade-off would manifest itself. And, you know, again, I'm not the guy in Millington making the decisions or pulling the levers or whatever. But it seems to me right now we're the way it's set up now is that you're going to accept the historical retention rate, and then you're going to assess officers each year to fill whatever amount of numbers you need down the road, given that retention, without, you know, and just kind of accepting that as it is. Hopefully that's not too rambly.
No, that actually was pretty good because I don't think many junior officers quite understand the complexities of looking that far down the road, trying to figure out what you're going to do with all these bodies. One of the curious things to me in your biography is that you started out, I guess, on a large deck amphib in engineering, and then went to a cruiser. And in my world, limited worldview these days of that, that seems like a rare thing that anybody gets to go from amphibs to cruisers. And maybe I'm wrong, but I got a couple of questions on this. One is that we have a large amphibious fleet, which seems to hold on to its officers and they don't get to go to cruisers and vice versa. The cruiser guys don't go to amphibs. Again, a perception thing on my part. But then we have these other groups, the minesweep guys, the PG guys, the literal combat ship guys. is there, how much intermingling is there? It, does this make sense to have all these different groups? And since you have these different ships, the Surface Warfare Officer qualification is ship-driven in addition to being, there are some standards that apply to all groups, but is there a enough cross flow and a cross decking among these various elements of our Navy that we get benefit? I know I went from in the old days we had like ammo ships manned by U.S. Navy people instead of USNS, and I went from there to a destroyer, and I had, since I'd been an unrep OD on, you know, maybe 50 or 60 unreps, I had vastly more experience than anybody on the destroyer did in doing that kind of thing, and that was a benefit to the ship, I think. But in your experience, is there enough cross-decking? Should we do more? How hard is it to transfer skill sets from one component to the other?
So I agree. I would agree with you. You know, just anecdotally, it tends to be, you know, tribal, right? So if you do crew des as a first tour, you're in a culture. You know, most everyone else on your destroyer or on your crew des platform is tends to be also a crew des, you know, by and large. They have served all their tours mainly on crew des, so they're going to talk up crew des, and so you're inculcated in that culture. And then when it comes for you to pick your next ship, you know, it's pretty natural that, oh, hey, you know, this crew des was good, and all the guys I talk to talk up crew des, so I'm not going to pick an amphib, I'm going to pick, you know, another crew des. And you see a similar thing on the amphib. If you're talking 1110s, I don't know what statistically, you know, how much cross pollination. I mean, in my personal, you know, my personal example, I just wanted to, before I made the decision of whether or not I wanted to stick in long term, I kind of just looked at the fleet and said, hey, we're largely a crew des Navy, just from like whole numbers. So, you know, the amphibs, there's a fair amount of amphibs, but it's not, you know, it's less than our crew des fleet. I want to, you know, when I was there on the amphib, people said, oh, amphibs, you know, way better, amphibs way worse, amphibs, you know, this and that compared to crew des. So I personally just wanted to experience, you know, a crew des platform before, you know, we kind of have to agree, or the first opportunity we have, or at least that I had, to say, hey, I want to stick on through department head, was going to be during that second division officer tour. So I just want, you know, I wanted to experience both, you know, types of major platform and see, you know, just for going forward, just, you know, whether I wanted to stick on, and then two, you know, okay, looking forward to the future, you know, do I fit in, quote unquote, better with the amphib type ship, or do I fit in better with the crew des? I think, you know, I don't know how much cross pollination there is. I'd imagine, just from personal experience, that most of it's kind of self, inflicted, you know, if that's the right way to say it. Because as surface warfare officers, it gets beat into us again, if all the instance, you know, the trajectory and the goal is to be a CO, is that you want to set yourself up, because you're going to screen from that based largely on your performance in your department head tours. And so if you, you know, served your division, your first division officer tour on an amphib, and you're surrounded with other amphib sailors, and they talk up how great amphib is, then you, you know, by and large, I'd imagine you would tend to pick an amphib for your second ship. So then you go to your second ship and you're on an amphib, and again, you're surrounded with like-minded folks. And so you've done your two division officer tours on amphibs, and now you're talking to the detailer, and you're trying to figure out where you want to go as a department head. And, you know, it's been beat into you that, hey, you know, your screening, you know, your XOCO screening is going to be based largely upon your performance as a department head. You know, quite honestly, the safer choice is to say, okay, I did my two division officer tours on amphibs. So I kind of understand that lifestyle and, you know, what's required. My experience was on an LPD as a DIVO, so I'm going to go to LPD as a department head because you're comfortable with that. So I don't necessarily see anything wrong with that, except that, you know, there are certain aspects of surface warfare proficiency that are more, that you experience more of on the different platforms. And if, again, the guy, you know, the goal is to make a relatively well-rounded officer, you know, it might behoove the surface Navy to, because you don't do any amphib ops on a crewed S, right? Just like you don't do any Tomahawk ops or strike ops on an amphib. So, you know, maybe the ideal officer would be someone who had a little bit of all that experience tied into a single career. For 1110s, for PCs and minesweeps, the career pipeline is built such that you can only do that once in a career anyway. And so I don't really, you know, one, there's relatively few holes that you could go to anyway. And it's not like you would do minesweep, 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 minesweep. So, you know, you go to a minesweep, I didn't serve on a minesweep, but, you know, for the guys who I talked to who have, you know, it's a much smaller crew. And so you get a lot more individual responsibility, which, you know, so you know, maybe extra leadership experience that you want to get on a crewed S, kind of maybe at the expense of tactical development. But, you know, it should be transferable to another hole when you go back. I think it's something to be cognizant of and say, hey, you know, maybe we should reward well-roundedness or total experience, right? Because once you get up to, you know, if you're a Commodore or, I don't know, beyond that, it might do the community better to have, you know, to reward well-roundedness. But I don't know if that necessarily should be at the expense of individual freedom and their preferences for, you know, ship assignment. I think, does that answer the question?
Yeah. One thing that you touched on briefly in the article that is something that I had many a long conversation having served for years with officers from other navies. And there are other navies, Royal Navy is a perfect example, that are much smaller than we are. But generally speaking, their ship handling capabilities are much more respected, and they are a lot more experienced in it. What are your thoughts about how other navies, their equivalent of surface warfare officers, things that they may do in their career path and their professional development that might be worth looking at on our end?
Yes, sir. So I've spoken, or I've served with officers who've done the foreign exchange cruises. You know, as in lieu of, say, an ashore duty, you can go serve with the Royal Navy or, you know, Spanish Navy or some other ship. Their systems, again, not as an expert, they're kind of, you know, fundamentally, pretty significantly different than the way we do things. Certain things. We had a French officer on first ship, and he was an exchange officer, but the equivalent of the French Naval Academy, you know, you pretty much, as soon as you went there, you obligated yourself, I think, almost 10, 15 years. So the initial obligation was significantly higher, you know, going into it. And I think ROTC, that kind of construct where you're going to go to a civilian school and then, you know, do a little bit of summer training and then go and be in the fleet, that doesn't really exist. In other services, definitely not the, you know, same, the minimum requirement for the Naval Academy is not 10, 15 years. So we'd have to, you know, that would instantly solve the retention problem for department heads. If you just said, hey, if you're going to go to Annapolis, you got to stick around through the end of your department head tours. So that's different. I know for the Royal Navy, they also, they separate and distinguish from an early, or, you know, there's three different tracks on the ship. So you can be a deck watch stander or a topsider as a junior officer. And so your watch standing duties are to become the most proficient deck watch officer that you can be. So you're never going to serve as engineering officer of the watch because you're not there to be the engineering officer of the watch. You're there to be the deck watch stander kind of thing. Same thing for the engineer. If you go in and I don't know how they do their designators, but you can be on the Royal Navy destroyer and you're an engineer officer. So, you know, there's a career pipeline or career track for an engineer officer that's not going to result in you being CO of the ship. So those would be pretty huge culture shifts for the American Navy to adopt because we are absolutely a generalist community. So everyone has to qualify as officer of the deck. Everyone has to qualify as engineer officer of the watch, everyone has to qualify as tactical action officer. So, I mean, there's I think there's merits to both. When you say, you know, their ship handlers are more, you know, experienced or well-regarded, I mean, it's because, you know, they're not trying to rotate their entire wardroom through the bridge to qualify, because all the engineers they have down there, they don't have to qualify, because that's not their career pipeline. Where, you know, OXO on an American ship has to get qualified on the bridge, and DCA has to get qualified on the bridge, because on his next tour, maybe he'll be the operations officer, or maybe he'll acquire that skill set. I, you know, again, my limited experience, and you know, only been in the Navy for a little while, I tend to think that the most effective, you know, I kind of like the idea of being broadly competent at all aspects of the ship, vice, you know, kind of the three different, the different tiers, or not tiers, the different, you know, tracks that some of the other services use, or the other, the foreign navies use. And I don't know how receptive, because I don't know if we've ever done it that way. I don't know how receptive the SWO community would be, because that'd be a pretty huge culture shift in the community. But, you know, so really it is they have a much smaller group of folks on the ship that they're training in any one given aspect of the ship, and so, you know, they are able to get a lot more experience in their particular area, but that comes at the expense of not having necessarily any ability to lead a different part of the ship, if that makes sense. So again, that's way above my pay grade, but I think a much more feasible solution would be to try and, you know, kind of correct the deficiency might be kind of too strong of a word, but maybe correct the issues we have with our current paradigm, vice, you know, switching to a foreign Navy paradigm of, okay, you're going to, you know, when you're a high school senior, you're going to agree to be in the Navy for 15 years, and you have to pick right off the bat whether or not you want to be a deck officer or you want to be an engineer officer. Because I don't think that would be I don't think it'd be received all that well in the American Navy.
Yeah, I was really impressed with. You had worked out. Let's talk a little bit about your number crunching that you did, because you talked about the Monte Carlo simulation that you ran that indicated the optimal arrival time on a ship is it's a 7 to 9 month point to the optimized fleet response plan, and that the worst time was, what, 25, 27 months into the cycle. Can you kind of talk about that? And while you're doing that, is there a way to optimize that for all the incoming officers, you know, by doing what the aviators do? You kind of stash some people sometimes and so they can get to a ship that's not going to go or is not currently in the yards, and you know, they're not stuck behind that burden.
Yes, sir. The... So if someone made me, you know, grandmaster or, you know, head of the fleet for the day, the easiest way to do it, which, again, I'm not saying it's feasible or it's actually ever going to happen, would be to serve as commissions. So essentially you would sign, instead of kind of being randomly assigned, not so much randomly assigned, you know, getting assigned to a ship, you know, wherever it happened to be in its cycle. And I know some foreign navies do this, you know, each time they go to a major availability in between deployments, they, you know, the ship decommissions, they fix everything, and then they get recommissions, and you would get a crew essentially from, you know, month one to month 36. So if you're not going to do that, the model essentially, so the fleet response plan is a 36-month cycle that says, okay, you're going to start on month one, which begins with the maintenance phase, so the start of CNO availability, typically going to the shipyard. And you're going to progress through the shipyard maintenance phase, pre-deployment training. You're going to go on deployment, and then you're going to come back, and you're going to do the optimized part is that there's a prolonged sustainment phase where the ship's going to maintain its qualifications as far as being surge ready to go on deployment for a 9-month period post-deployment before you start over again because you're decertified once you enter your maintenance phase. You know, all models are wrong. Some models are useful. my model assumed, which is as true as far as I know, that you have, you know, all things being equal, you have a equal chance of showing up to a ship that's along, you know, in one of 36 months of your of the OFRP cycle. If you just made the ship, you know, commission based, every officer would show up on month one, and then you wouldn't leave the ship until you completed your cycle at month 36. So that would instantly, you know, create a baseline experience of, you know, division or any tour that you served on. The next best thing, I think, would be to prolong, which I mentioned in the article, would be to prolong division officer tours similar to the submarine community. So the submarines, you're on a sub for 3 years. So there's not really a first and second division officer tour. You do one division officer tour, one department head tour, you know, one XO tour that are of longer single duration. So again, it's not necessarily guaranteed that you would complete, you know, a maintenance phase, a deployment, all that kind of thing. So you might do two deployments or you might do two shipyards, but you're, you know, essentially guaranteed to at least experience all of, or you're more likely to experience all of the phases of a ship cycle if the ship or if the tour length is equivalent to the operational cycle. And barring that, the other option is to, you know, as far as I know right now, there's no official consideration given to when you transfer between ships, any official recognition. Okay, I left my ship in the middle of deployment, so when I transferred to my next ship, you know, big Navy wants our big, you know, the SWO community wants to make sure I have a full deployment in my tour. So, you know, we're going to get you to a ship that's at about the same time that your previous ship was. I like to think that would be the easiest. Again, I'm not the manning, you know, I'm not a detailer, and I don't necessarily have all the information as far as the variables they're working with. But if they could just, you know, if they could add to the factors that they're considering, that it's important for a junior officer to experience the entirety of the ship cycle. Again, with the vision being, hey, this person's going to be a CO and he or she needs to have experienced, you know, as much of a ship cycle as they could before being in charge of, you know, essentially getting a ship through an operational cycle, that we're going to make a conscious effort to get them through, you know, as much of the 36 months of a ship cycle that we can, given that they're going to keep a 24-month tour length on a junior officer's tours. So, you know, commission solves everything. I don't know how politically feasible that is, but I think the easiest thing to do would be to kind of mimic the submarine community and, you know, increasing the duration of bore length on individual platforms, vice kind of divvying them up. The SWO nukes present a unique challenge because they have, you know, they need to go beyond the carrier. But for the conventional SWOs, I think someone could work it out, you know, an effective career pipeline that, you know, promoted quality and breadth of experience on individual tours, vice, you know, serving multiple tours within each kind of leadership band, whether it be DIVO or department head.
Brendan, as we wind up the hour, I'm just curious a couple things. One, what type of reception have you received so far since the article published? And are you looking at writing something else for publication soon? And if so, what topic would it be?
Yes, sir. I don't know if it's one of those things where, you know, people don't want to be too mean or whatever. So you're not, you know, even if it's people that you know, they're going to say, hey, Brendan, I think you're way off the reservation. So the feedback, you know, I don't think the problem itself is necessarily all that controversial, like the issue of, you know, because it's a challenge for a lot of ships on the waterfront is just, you know, getting, because everyone wants their, you know, everyone wants the ship to be successful. Everyone wants their junior officers to be successful. So the reception as far as the article itself has been fairly well received. As far as looking forward, the Naval Institute is doing a history essay contest that I'm trying to put something together for. I don't know if I'll give the topic away too broadly, but I'm trying to look at so the submarine force in World War II had a little bit of an issue early on with quite honestly, it's characterized as the aggressiveness of their COs based on their pre-war training. And then when World War II, you know, their paradigm, they were no longer operating with the fleet. They weren't engaged and concentrated, you know, they weren't with the carriers. The submarines were off doing their own thing, trying to destroy merchant shipping. I think we can draw some parallels between what the submarine community had to do back in World War II with kind of transforming their training pipeline for their COs, and what the service Navy is trying to do with the distributed lethality and getting away from, you know, concentrated groups of surface ships and more spread out individual ships to increase the calculus for adversaries as far as, you know, what can each individual ship kind of operating autonomously, or group as a small group of ships operating relatively autonomously vice one huge carrier strike group. So that's my next project that I'm looking forward to putting together. I don't know if anything will come out of it, but it's been interesting to take a look at.
Excellent. Well, we wish you the best of luck, Brendan, and good luck with your midshipman over at George Washington University, and I look forward to reading your byline again soon.
Hey, and thank you very much, sir. I appreciate the conversation, and it's been a great pleasure to be here with you this afternoon.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Brendan. Enjoyed the talk. Thank you.
And thank you very much for joining us for another edition of MidRats. Until next time, I hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the stranded.